The following is a repeat broadcast of Health Matters, and no phone calls will be taken tonight.
Good evening, and welcome to Health Matters. I'm Dr. Sanford Katz, and I'll be your host for this show as we talk about gynecologic cancer. Gynecologic cancers are talked about as often as aren't as talked about as often as other forms of cancer, but according to the CDC, over 94,000 women are diagnosed with some form of gynecologic cancer each year. Some of these forms of cancer can help to save the lives of women, as awareness of symptoms and early detection can make a huge difference in outcomes. This evening, I'm joined in the studio by a number of physicians who treat gynecologic cancers. We are joined by Dr. Destin Black, a gynecologist-oncologist at Willis-Knighton, Dr. Maxwell McDonald, medical oncologist at Willis-Knighton, and Dr. Lane Rosen, radiation oncologist at the Willis-Knighton Cancer Center. Welcome.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay. So to start off, I would first like for our listeners to know that this is a live show this evening, and we welcome your calls and questions for our guests, and you can do that by calling 1-800-552-8502. Now, to start off, we have three physicians, all of whom treat cancer from a slightly different perspective: a medical oncologist, a radiation oncologist, and a gynecologic oncologist. So, Dr. Black, as a gynecologic oncologist, can you tell our listeners what makes your training different from the other doctors here?
Well, as a gynecologic oncologist, like Dr. Rosen and Dr. McDonald, I also went to medical school. But after medical school, we each took different paths. My path actually involved a four-year OBGYN residency and then a four-year gynecologic oncology fellowship, which was primarily focused on surgeries. So the skills that I learned during that training were focused on very complicated pelvic surgeries to address primarily the three main types of cancers that I treat, which are ovarian, cervical, and uterine cancer. But also part of that training involved learning about chemotherapy, which is what Dr. McDonald focuses on in his practice, and also regarding radiation oncology, which is what Dr. Rosen focuses on.
Okay. And Dr. McDonald, as a medical oncologist, what was your training like?
So after medical school, we do an internal medicine residency, which is 3 years, and then follow that up with a sort of combined fellowship in hematology and medical oncology, which is an additional 3 years. And that training, while focused on cancer, is on a much more broad variety of malignancies, as well as blood disorders on the hematology side. That's completely different than what Dr. Black and Dr. Rosen do.
Okay, and Dr. Rosen, your training?
So I'm a radiation oncologist, and after medical school and a year of internship, you do a four-year residency in radiation oncology, which is really dedicated just to training specific for using X-ray therapy or radiation therapy to treat cancers. And I also have an interest in female cancers, which is one of the reasons why we're here tonight.
Okay, great. All right, so we're going to talk about different forms of female cancers, and we're going to use a number of anatomical names that some people may not be that familiar with. So I think to kind of set the stage for our conversation, I'd like to have just a brief review of the anatomy, the pertinent anatomy. Now, we don't have any illustrations, but Dr. Rosen, could you please kind of run through the anatomy of the female urogenital tract and kind of set the stage so we know these different terms and what they mean, and and what these different organs and how they function.
Sure. I mean, you know, most of the cancers that we're dealing with tonight involve the female urogenital tract, and we're talking about the uterus. Everyone is familiar with the uterus, commonly called the womb, and frequently cancers will occur on the inner lining of the uterus, or what we call the endometrium. The connection between the vagina and the uterus is an area known as the cervix, and commonly people will, when pregnant, will refer to their cervix being dilated to allow the passage of a baby. And these organs, as well as the ovaries, and are all at risk of various malignancies. And so the majority of the cancers that we, especially Dr. Black and I, will focus on will be vulvar, vaginal, uterine, ovarian type cancers.
Okay. And then there's the vulvar
and cervical.
And vulvar cancers. Okay. So, and the vulva is the...
The opening of the vagina.
The opening, the outside. Okay. So I guess we hear a lot about cervical cancer, probably more than anything else, and pap smears and cervical evaluations are part of the routine screening that women are recommended to have. So let's start off with that. So cervical cancer, Dr. Black, so how would someone know if they had cervical cancer? Are there any particular symptoms?
Well, there are actually symptoms of cervical cancer, but most of the symptoms for cervical cancer don't occur until later on in terms of more advanced stage. But in the United States, most women actually learn about cervical cancer because they had a pap smear performed, which was abnormal. And so basically what a pap smear is when you go to the physician and they examine your cervix and they basically take a smear of the cervix, and the cells that are falling off of the cervix, which is normal, are looked at under a microscope, and they're determined if to be normal or abnormal. So in the United States, you know, there's only like 15,000 new cases of cervical cancer, but in some countries where they don't have screening programs for this, it's actually a leading killer of young women. So fortunately here, we have great screening programs. Most of the time when I see a patient who has cervical cancer, most of the time they haven't had a pap smear within 5 years. So that's definitely a problem, is educating women about how important the screening is. But also, we now have an excellent vaccine for cervical cancer that helps to decrease, you know, the risk of getting cervical cancer.
So how does a vaccine work against a cancer?
Well, with cervical cancer, it's actually interesting. It's actually caused by a virus. So 99.9% of cervical cancers are caused by a virus. And this vaccine targets the most common strains of the virus, and this is called the HPV virus, or human papillomavirus. So with this vaccine, it allows the body's immune system to attack the virus when the person is exposed, so they don't ever get to the point where they develop cancer. And it's actually quite effective in decreasing cervical cancer, as well as head and neck and vaginal and vulvar cancers.
Is there a particular age that somebody should get the HPV vaccine?
Yes, it's actually approved as young as 11, and that's actually the ideal age. You'd like to give the vaccine to individuals before they're exposed to the virus.
Okay, and what if they're like in their 30s and they've never had the vaccine? Would it be beneficial at that point?
It's still thought to be beneficial, but the greatest benefit is if you can give it to people at the younger ages.
Okay, so now you mentioned the pap smear. So if a woman has a pap smear and it's positive, does that necessarily mean that she has cervical cancer?
No, actually, a pap smear is just a screening tool. So a pap smear, it's just when the cervix looks totally normal to the physician who's doing the exam, that's when they do the pap smear. And like any screening tool, you can have, you know, false negatives and false positives. It's not perfect. But it also, when you look at a pap smear and you receive the report from the pathologist, there are different degrees of abnormality. Some of them are very low-grade abnormal, and some of them are more aggressive or high grade, and depending on what that read is, that's when we decide what the next step will be.
Okay. Now, the reason why I'm asking you most of these questions right now is because one could say that you're almost like the gatekeeper of the GYN cancers? I mean, I know that you're a specialist and that generally these tests, these pap smears, are done by regular gynecologists, not necessarily gynecologists who have advanced training in cancer treatment like you do. But you would be the person that would ultimately, the patient would see for cervical cancer that was discovered, at least initially, from a abnormal pap smear.
Correct. So I don't usually even perform pap smears in my office. I actually see patients once they've been diagnosed with cervical cancer. And so that's really important. The one misconception I see a lot about pap smears is that people go to their doctor and they have a pap smear, but then they later find out they have ovarian cancer or some other cancer, and they think that pap smears look for these other cancers, but truly, pap smears look for cervical cancer, and that's it, you know. So it is important to understand that when you're having that screening test, that pelvic exam once a year with your OBGYN or your family medicine doctor, that these are really looking for cervical cancer, not other female malignancies.
You're listening to a repeat broadcast of Health Matters. No phone calls will be taken tonight.
Okay, so this pap smear should be done on an annual basis for sexually active young women, and if there's something abnormal, I assume that there's some intermediary between, you know, coming to see you or having be treated for cancer.
Yeah, so it's actually, we start doing pap smears at the age of 21. And depending on other risk factors, you know, usually we stop when the patients are older, but it's really independent of their sexual activity. So we start screening at 21 regardless of sexual activity.
Okay. Is sexual activity relevant when it comes to cervical cancer?
Well, it is thought that, you know, exposure to the HPV vaccine, exposure to HPV virus is necessary to actually get cervical cancer. So, yes, if you have more exposure, then you have a higher risk of getting cervical cancer.
Okay. And last question on the screening. So if someone has abnormal cells and then they need to undergo some form of a surgical procedure, but not necessarily something that you would perform, what kind of things are potential treatments for someone who has abnormal cells on a pap smear?
So once you have an abnormal pap smear, which is abnormal cells, and there's different levels of abnormalities, the next step before surgery, because sometimes you don't need surgery. Sometimes they're low grade and your immune system will take care of it and handle it, and we just kind of follow you and monitor you closely. But before you get to the next step of surgery, we do a biopsy. And that biopsy is where you get the diagnosis of, say, completely normal or cancer or some level in between. And depending on what the biopsy results are, that will dictate really what your next step will be. And there are some surgical options for precancerous lesions that I think you're trying to get at, which would be like a cold knife conization, where that procedure is where we removed a cone-shaped piece of the cervix from your cervix, and that is both diagnostic and also it can be therapeutic. But the other procedures that we perform for treatment of precancerous lesions, some of them can be done in the office. We can perform laser procedures. We can also perform a procedure called a LEAP, where you can have that done in the office or in the operating room, where you're just taking a loop type cautery and removing a piece of the cervix. So those are the most common procedures performed.
Okay, so let's say that's performed and ultimately it's decided that this patient needs to be referred to a specialist like yourself. Can you walk us through the process by which you might evaluate someone and determine whether they had a cancer that needed to be treated and how you would decide what kind of treatment they needed?
Okay, so basically when I first see the patient, I look at the pathology report from the procedure that led to the diagnosis of cancer. And what I'm looking at is for the size of the tumor on the pathology report. If it's very, very small, what we call microinvasive, it's not any deeper than 3 millimeters. Many of those patients do not, they can actually have a fertility sparing option. Say they're very young and they want to have children, we can do another cone. Sometimes we'll repeat a cone, or the cone they had may be sufficient. So the first thing I do is I try to figure out how extensive the cancer is. And if it's very early, then they may not even need to have another surgery. If it is if it's more involved, then the main decision that I'm making is this patient a surgical candidate, or would this patient benefit more from treatment with chemotherapy and radiation usually? And for me, usually the deciding factor is if the cancer has spread past the cervix, then they're usually no longer a candidate for surgery. And that situation, I recommend treatment usually with radiation, and then addition to radiation, we give low-dose chemotherapy to act as a what we call radiation sensitizer. It's thought to make the radiation more effective.
Okay, so when you say beyond the cervix, you mean into some of the other organs, whether it be into the vagina or up into the uterus, or maybe even into the other tissues.
Into the other tissues.
Okay, or perhaps even spread to beyond that.
Fortunately, most of the time when it's beyond the cervix, it has not spread too far away. It's not usually in the lungs or the liver or other places at the time of diagnosis. Most of the time, if it's spread beyond the cervix, it's limited to the pelvic area. So it hasn't spread too far. So usually we can effectively treat that with radiation and chemotherapy because it will be in the area where the radiation is effective.
Okay, and in what circumstances might someone just have surgery and no radiation?
A patient would be a good candidate for surgery if the tumor were confined to the cervix itself and had not spread.
And what kind of surgery would that be?
It's usually a hysterectomy, and it's a special kind of hysterectomy. It's a radical hysterectomy where we remove the cervix and the surrounding tissue. We also do have surgical options for young women that want to preserve their fertility where we remove the cervix and the tissue around it, and then put a permanent cerclage so that they can carry a pregnancy. And that's called a trachelectomy, or radical trachelectomy.
So you don't necessarily need to remove the uterus?
Not always.
And the ovaries?
The ovaries in this type of cancer can actually stay. We don't have to take the ovaries out with cervical cancer.
Okay. Now, let's say you've decided that this patient perhaps is not a good candidate for one of those surgical options, and that they will need radiation and potentially chemotherapy. Okay. So, Dr. Rosen, let's come over to the radiation side. So, can you explain to our listeners what is radiation and how is it given in the treatment of this kind of cancer?
Yes. So radiation therapy is really, it's X-ray therapy. These are very high-energy X-rays that are targeted to the part of the body that you're concerned about. We will oftentimes use CAT scans or PET scans, physical exam findings to help determine what part of the body we need to treat. And with cervical cancer, you know, that's going to typically be in the pelvis or the pelvis and the low abdomen. And it's a very common form of treatment for cervical cancer. And in this part of the country, I think to tie back a little bit earlier with your comments about the vaccine, we are in an area where we're a little underserved with physicians, and oftentimes patients are not vaccinated for the HPV virus in this part of the country to the degree that they should be. And as a result, we often see these more advanced cervical cancers that do require radiation therapy with curative intent. And we have numerous studies that show that if you add chemotherapy to the radiation therapy, that it's much more effective. And so we use both treatments together.
Okay. Dr. McDonald, what exactly is chemotherapy and how is it given with the radiation?
Chemotherapy is really just a medication that's used to treat cancer. So it can be intravenous, it can be oral. There's various forms of chemotherapy. In this case, we typically use a drug called cisplatin, and that's an intravenous treatment. Typically, the radiation lasts for 6 up to maybe 7 weeks, and the chemotherapy is given once a week in the cancer center during the entire course of the radiation.
Okay, and the chemotherapy, are there side effects typically associated with that?
Well, yes. So most people have heard, you know, stories about chemotherapy, and generally people have heard bad stories about chemotherapy, but it can certainly cause weakness, fatigue, nausea, vomiting, hair loss, low blood counts, problems with nerves, problems with kidneys. However, I would say over the last 20 years or so, some of the medications that we use to prevent some of these side effects have greatly improved. And so while the chemotherapy drugs themselves are sometimes the old drugs that we've been using for a long time, the side effects have lessened because of these supportive care drugs have lessened those side effects.
You're listening to a repeat broadcast of Health Matters. No phone calls will be taken tonight.
Okay, and the thing that a lot of people are concerned about is losing their hair.
Now, right.
How common is that?
Well, it depends on which drug. So, for example, in cervical cancer, we typically use a drug, the drug called cisplatin, and the risk of hair loss with that drug is very minimal.
Okay. And thank you. And Dr. Rosen, so we understand that there's different types of chemotherapy, and there's specific chemotherapy that's used in treatment of cervical cancer. Are there different types of radiation?
There are several different kinds of radiation therapy. We have deeply penetrating X-rays called photons, more superficial type of X-rays that are treating more areas that are close to the surface called electrons. In our facility, we're very lucky also to have something called protons, which is a very advanced form of radiation that doesn't exit the patient's body like a typical X-ray. And then there's a number of isotopes as well as something called brachytherapy. And patients who end up in our department frequently will require a form of radiation that you apply directly to a tumor or inside of an organ. And that's what brachytherapy is, which stands for close therapy. It's B-R-A-C-H-Y therapy. And it's a procedure that allows us to place the radiation very close to the tumor so that we can protect some of those tissues that are nearby.
Okay. And when you're giving these kind of treatments, any long-term effects from the radiation?
Yeah, there certainly can be. With any of these treatments, there can be long-term side effects. And for us, they're very targeted. Radiation therapy, if you think about our field, much like if you go to see a doctor and you have a cold or a chest cold and they do a chest X-ray, you don't really see the patient's feet on the X-ray. So with radiation therapy, where you aim the beams is where you tend to see side effects. So most of the treatment is actually quite well tolerated, but anytime you're treating the part of the body that's near the bladder and the bowel and other healthy structures, you have the risk of side effects. Most of them are short-lived. They're mostly things like frequent urination or frequent bowel movements, fatigue, and skin changes in the field.
And sexual side effects?
It absolutely. One of the things we try to do is after a course of radiation therapy, we encourage our patients to see specialized physical therapists and to use certain preventative measures like dilators to try to prevent discomfort with intercourse in the future. But there's no question that you have a tumor in this organ of the body, and it requires therapy. And so the vast majority of patients are going to have some impact on sexual function.
Okay, so it sounds from what I'm hearing is that cervical cancer at its earliest stages, caught early, can potentially be treated with a more minimal type of therapy, even a surgery that preserves fertility, and in more advanced cases requires more intensive treatment like radiation, chemotherapy, and maybe surgery too, maybe even all three.
It's a little rare that we'll use all three. Typically, most of the studies have demonstrated that adding surgery to chemotherapy and radiation therapy may be a little bit more toxic for the patient. And that said, there are certain situations where that would be indicated. So if we had a patient that we treated and their involved lymph nodes and their, let's say, large cervical tumor were to disappear, but maybe a year later were to recur right at the cervix, that would be the sort of situation where a triple modality adding surgery would be of benefit and potentially still curative.
Okay. So what I, in preparing for the show, I actually looked up some statistics, and it seems as though that women who have their abnormal pap smear, you know, who don't actually get cervical cancer, they obviously have the best survival. But when caught very early, the survivals are very, very good in the early stages. But, of course, as you get more advanced disease, it spreads further, even goes to lymph nodes, the survivals get worse and worse. So I guess the take-home message is here, the pap smear is very, very important.
The good news, though, Dr. Katz, is that we, even when the lymph nodes are involved, even if they're more extensive lymph nodes, we still have a fairly high chance of cure in these patients. So it is important that we try to catch this disease early, because clearly we'd like to avoid as much treatment as possible. But in 2021, I think we can safely say that the majority of women with cervical cancer will be cured.
That sounds great. That's very encouraging.
You're listening to a repeat broadcast of Health Matters. No phone calls will be taken tonight.
And Dr. Black, just last thing about the pap smear. Are there women who perhaps might be able to get pap smears less frequently, or let's say stop pap smears at some point?
Yes. So after a hysterectomy, you can actually stop having your pap smears done if the indication for the hysterectomy was not for cervical abnormalities like cervical dysplasia or even early cervical cancer. And if you've also had normal pap smears in the years prior to that. So in that situation, it's acceptable to discontinue pap smears. But it's still recommended that you have a general exam, a general pelvic exam once a year.
Okay. And during that pelvic exam, what is probably another cancer that you might pick up on a pelvic exam that perhaps the person might not even know that they had?
Well, the examination involves inspection of the vulvar and vaginal tissue and also palpation of the pelvic area, especially if the patients still have ovaries in place.
Okay. And how about the uterus? And the uterus is actually, uterine cancer is actually more common than cervical cancer.
Yes.
Although maybe we don't talk about it nearly as much as cervical cancer. So Dr. Rosen said earlier that uterine cancer is often a cancer of the lining of the womb.
Yeah, that's correct. Actually, uterine cancer is really the most common gynecologic malignancy that I see. There's more than 50,000 new cases a year in the United States, and that number is continuing to rise. The good thing about uterine cancer, even though we don't have a screening test for it like we have the pap smear for cervical cancer, is most of the time women present with a symptom that brings them to the doctor, and 80% of the time uterine cancer, also known as endometrial cancer, is stage one. So it carries a really good prognosis most of the time.
And are there any particular causes of, you mentioned like the virus, the HPV virus, being a cause of cervical cancer. Are there any specific causes for uterine cancer?
So uterine cancer is not associated with a virus. It's actually, like Dr. Rosen said, it starts on the endometrial lining, so the lining of the inside of the uterus. It's very sensitive to the hormonal changes in a woman's body. And so when patients have excess adipose tissue, there's actually a hormone in that tissue called aromatase.
Adipose meaning?
Fat.
Fat.
Yes. And so with that excess tissue, with that enzyme, it causes conversion of a hormone that's normally found in your body to estrogen. And so you have this estrogen affecting the lining of the inside of the uterus and causing endometrial cancer. So we are seeing that more, as you know, we have an obesity crisis in this country. And so we're seeing with that an increase in endometrial cancer. Most of these women will present usually with what we call postmenopausal bleeding, which means that after they've already gone through the change of life, they've gone through menopause, they've stopped having their menstrual cycles, then they start to have bleeding or spotting or discharging, and they go to their doctor at that time. Most of the time they do at that time, and then they have an endometrial biopsy, which is a simple procedure. It can be performed in the doctor's office, and that's when the diagnosis is made. But it's also important to know that most of the time when a woman starts to have bleeding after going through menopause, most commonly it's not endometrial cancer. So women should not be afraid to go to the doctor when they have this symptom. Most of the time it's what we call atrophy, which is just thinning of the tissue, or it's a polyp. But it's very important to know and to rule out cancer, because in the early stages it's very, very treatable and carries an excellent prognosis.
Are there any other things that put women at risk for uterine cancer, let's say fibroids?
Well, fibroids are not a risk factor for uterine cancer. Fibroids are just a smooth muscle tumor that are benign, and it doesn't increase your risk one way or the other of actually having endometrial cancer. But there are certain medications that we take, one common medication you hear about is tamoxifen, for instance, for breast cancer. If you're on that medicine, it does give you a little bit higher risk of having endometrial cancer, but the benefit for the treatment of breast cancer actually outweighs the risk for endometrial cancer. And there are some other medications similar to that drug that are given for breast cancer treatment. And then there's also genetic predisposition. There are some families. The one that we hear about the most is called Lynch syndrome, or HNPCC, where you see family members that are more prone to endometrial cancer and also colon cancer or even ovarian cancer. So that would be another risk factor for that. And then simply just getting older. As you get older, you're at higher risk for these cancers.
What about having an IUD?
Now, an IUD is actually thought to be protective of endometrial cancer, especially the more commonly used one that releases progesterone.
And what about having an abortion?
I'm not aware of anything that shows that having an abortion puts you at a higher risk of endometrial cancer.
You're listening to a repeat broadcast of Health Matters. No phone calls will be taken tonight.
Okay. Well, we have a question. We have a caller. We have Christina from Pollock. Christina?
Hi.
Hi. Welcome to Health Matters. Thanks for calling in. What's your question?
Thank you for taking my call. Well, I have PCOS, polycystic ovarian syndrome, and I wanted to know if any of you had experience with someone with PCOS and seeing them present any types of cancer.
Okay, Dr. Black.
With cancer.
So PCOS is, like you said, it's polycystic ovarian syndrome. That's typically managed by a general OBGYN, but it does put you at a higher risk of endometrial cancer. It's a slightly higher risk. So, and that just has to do with the way the hormonal influence is on the endometrial lining. So you should definitely pay attention to your menstrual cycles. If you start to notice that they're getting heavier, or you're having bleeding between your cycles, you should, definitely take that seriously and have that evaluated.
Okay, and then postmenopausal, what would some of the things be once I'm not having a period anymore? I guess a regular screening with my doctor every year?
Yes, you should definitely once a year have regular screening with your doctor after you've gone through menopause. And also don't forget, the screening with mammograms are very important, as well as your colonoscopies and all those other good things that come along. When you go in for your annual visit, usually those come up, and that's part of the examination and discussion.
Sounds really fun. I'm looking forward
to it. Yes, yes. Well, good luck to you.
Thanks for calling in.
Thank you so much.
Sure, you're thanks
welcome.
For calling in. Some great information. If you have a question you'd like to ask, like Christina, the number again is 1-800-552-8502. Getting back, Dr. Black, a couple other things with the endometrial cancer, the uterine cancer. What about women who take hormone therapy after menopause? Is that something that can increase your risk of developing uterine cancer, or protect, or does it matter?
Actually, that's a great question. Going through menopause, women definitely experience lots of symptoms, most commonly hot flashes, but they also worry about bone loss and other issues that come along with that. And there was a large study, it was called the Women's Health Initiative, and it looked at giving women hormones after menopause. And this study, actually, the women in it were in their 60s. And the interesting thing that they found out in this study, there were two groups of women. One of them had already had a hysterectomy, so they didn't have a uterus. And the other had a uterus. So if a woman still has her uterus, if she takes estrogen, she also has to take progesterone. Because you remember I said the endometrial lining is really affected by the hormones. And if you take estrogen, you need to have progesterone as well, which are two separate hormones, if you still have your uterus. And what they found out in that study is actually the women that had to take the progesterone actually had a slightly higher risk of breast cancer. And so these are discussions that each patient should make individually with their doctor, talking about the risk and the benefits. And a lot of it has to do with whether they still have their uterus and they have to take the progesterone or not, but also looking at their risk for breast cancer and their family history, and some genetics as well come into that conversation.
Okay, excellent. So I suppose getting back to what we were saying before, the primary physician, the traditional obstetrician gynecologist is the person that you see for these kind of complaints, these kind of issues. I presume a biopsy is performed of the uterine lining to determine whether there's something abnormal. And at some point, the uterine cancer is identified and the patient makes their way to you, Dr. Vilak. And then treatment is recommended based upon the extent of the disease. The treatment for uterine cancer typically is what?
Yeah, so with uterine cancer, the treatment's a complete hysterectomy. When I say that, I mean uterus, cervix, both tubes and ovaries. And the other thing that you have in addition to that is you have assessment of the lymph nodes, so we do biopsies. And in the old days, we used to do a large up and down incision, and we take out, 30 lymph nodes from your pelvic area. But nowadays, we have much better technology in the operating room. And so this procedure is usually performed with what we call a minimally invasive approach. So you have pretty small incisions, but the standard is a hysterectomy. And typically, in my patients, I offer them most of the time a robotic approach, where I'm able to remove all of these structures through small incisions, and the studies have shown equivalent in terms of how well they do in terms of their prognosis from the cancer. And 75% of my patients after this procedure will go home actually the same day.
Wow.
But it's not until about a week after surgery that I know what the next step will be. And after that, what we look at is the report from the operation, because the pathologists, who are very important in this all, will look at each part of the cervix and uterus and the lymph nodes under a microscope, and they will generate a report for us to look at. And then that's when I involve my colleagues, Dr. McDonald and Dr. Rosen, often in this discussion. So they can talk a little bit more about that part, but typically if the cancer has spread, say, to the lymph nodes, it's going to be a different stage for one, but it's also going to be a different treatment plan than, say, somebody who the cancer was confined to the uterus.
Okay, great. Well, that's a great idea. Let's involve your colleagues, Dr. McDonald and Dr. Rosen, in our discussion. Okay, so now, Dr. McDonald, so under what circumstances might Dr. Black call you up on the phone and say, Dr. McDonald, I have a patient for you I'd like to see. I think she could use some of your therapy.
So that's a good question, because the three of us speak almost on a daily basis about various patients, but I would say the majority of our conversations have to do with endometrial cancer, because there are so many different treatment options and so many different scenarios. So chemotherapy would be given after surgery for a variety of indications, such as if the patient had stage 3 or stage 4 disease, meaning that the cancer had spread outside of the pelvis or if it had spread to the lymph nodes. We would also give chemotherapy for even stage 1 or stage 2 disease if it was a different specific type of endometrial cancer. So there's not just one type of endometrial cancer. There's different what we call histologies. So when the pathologist looks at the cancer cells under the microscope, they may have something called an endometrioid carcinoma. They may have a clear cell carcinoma. They may have a serous carcinoma. Of course, now I'm using medical terms, which is what you asked me not to do earlier. But depending on which one of those cell types, sometimes the patients get chemotherapy, even if they only have stage 1 endometrial cancer.
So Dr. Black mentioned hormones and the hormonal effects on the uterine lining. Are hormones ever used? And she also mentioned some hormone therapy that for breast cancer, let's say, that can increase your risk for developing uterine cancer. Are hormones ever used to treat uterine cancer?
Yes, but typically that would be later. So that might be after a patient had a recurrence and they developed metastatic disease. That would be more commonly when we would use hormone therapy.
Okay, great.
You're listening to a repeat broadcast of Health Matters. No phone calls will be taken tonight.
And Dr. Rosen, when do you get involved in this, the treatment of this disease?
So it may be helpful for your listeners to understand the difference between stage and grade. We often will have patients say, well, what stage am I? And they'll hear their grade and get the two confused. From a simplistic way of looking at it, the grade is really how a tumor looks under a microscope. How much does it look like the area where it originated? And it oftentimes gives us a hint of how aggressive a tumor is. Stage of disease is a measure of the prognosis of a patient, how well they'll do after therapy. And so when we're making decisions for what we call adjuvant radiotherapy or using radiation after surgery, we're going to look at a number of different factors: the stage of disease, the grade of the disease, how, and the stage often is determined by how deep into the uterus the tumor may extend, or if it extends to the cervix, or if it extends to the lymph nodes. So we use a combination of the size of the tumor, the stage of disease, the grade of disease, to try to determine if a patient will benefit from the use of radiotherapy. And that may be external beam radiation therapy, which is quite common, where a patient will come Monday to Friday, 5 days a week, for anywhere from 4 to 5.5 weeks. Or what we call brachytherapy, where we insert a device into the vagina to try to get radiotherapy right to the top of the cuff where the tumor originally presented, or even more frequently, a combination of the two. And so we'll make those decisions often in cooperation together. I mean, Dr. McDonald mentioned that we speak almost every day. The three of us really oftentimes have to hash out the best way to treat a patient, because it's a very individualized disease. Uterine cancer is not a cookbook disease, and it's important that you have experienced physicians that are aware of the latest literature so they can decide the best way to treat a patient.
Got it. So now you all specialize in this. I mean, and that's, I guess, we're very fortunate being in a town and having facilities where people actually specialize in the various types of cancer. But, you know, I mean, this is a pretty rural state. People travel, I know, long distances for specialized care. And you said that patients may get treated over the course of a number of weeks daily. That sounds like that can be a challenge for people who live far away. Are there services or is there any assistance that might be available to people for whom that is a challenge?
It's a huge challenge. Chemotherapy may be given either in some cases weekly, in other cases every few weeks. Radiotherapy given every day. Oftentimes, patients are traveling to Shreveport, and a lot of this is because Dr. Black is here. We have very few gynecologic oncologists in the upper two-thirds of the state. So we'll have patients coming here from Lafayette, Lake Charles, Monroe, Alexandria, pretty much almost daily. So a couple of our former patients did create the Caddo-Bossier Cancer Foundation League, which is a very nice organization that raises money to help assist some of these patients with housing and transportation. We get them discounted hotel rooms. Oftentimes, they can even stay at some Willis Knighton facilities. It's been a godsend. Some of these patients, to be totally honest, would probably perish without that kind of assistance. We also have tremendous social workers who really work hard to try to help us find the best way to get a patient treatment. And there are some cases also where we will change again the approach. I mean, I sometimes will use a technique where we give slightly bigger doses of radiotherapy on a daily basis to try to shorten the overall treatment course. And that's where some of the technologies we have also come in very handy, like the proton therapy and some of these treatment machines that allow us to to reduce side effects while still giving good care.
Yeah. So you mentioned state-of-the-art care, cutting-edge care, keeping up with the literature, and patients, you know, certainly want to be getting the latest cutting-edge treatment and are interested even in clinical trials. Are there any clinical trials available for the treatment of gynecologic cancers at your facility?
Yes, we actually have a lot of great clinical trials, and we're in the process of opening some some other great trials. You know, at our institution, we're very fortunate. Our hospital's really focused on supporting the clinical research, and you know, we're meeting about it daily and weekly, trying to improve it. But clinical trials, I hope people out there realize how important they are for science. Every single medication that everybody takes has gone through a clinical trial. And I think it's wonderful that it's, you know, in the news a lot more because we're more aware of it, especially with the COVID pandemic. But we have been very fortunate to have some great trials here. We have a person at our institution named Carrie Kay who's really sort of spearheaded this and helped us put this together. And these are trials we work through this organization called Gynecologic Oncology Group, and they're the exact same trial that you can get if you travel to, say, New York City or Houston or Dallas, but they're closer to home. And it gives patients an opportunity to really get some cutting-edge medications that would not otherwise be available.
So I've heard sometimes patients say, well, I don't want to do that. I don't want the doctors experimenting on me. But at the same time, other patients kind of recognize that, hey, wait a minute, it's good to be in a clinical trial. So, Dr. McDonald, how would you answer a question like that if a patient had some concerns? And how would you explain the benefits of being in a clinical trial?
So the benefits of a clinical trial are sort of twofold. The patient may benefit from the clinical trial because they may receive a treatment that is better than the current standard of care. Most of the trials that we are doing are what are called phase three trials, where these are randomized trials where the patient gets put into one of two groups, and one group gets the standard of care treatment, and the other group gets the standard of care plus a new treatment or an additional treatment. So the patients have roughly a 50% chance of receiving a treatment that is at least potentially better than what we have to offer outside of a clinical trial. I say potentially because we don't know that the clinical trial treatment will be better than the standard of care. If we knew that, then we wouldn't have to do the clinical trial. In terms of, you know, when patients think they're being experimented on, there's already a couple of things about that. There's already data from previously done clinical trials that give us some evidence that this new treatment is going to be beneficial. Those are called phase one or phase two trials. And then the last thing I try to tell patients is that even if you are on the trial and you wind up getting the standard treatment or the standard of care, like Dr. Black said, clinical trials are extremely important in the field of medicine, and this is how we learn and this is how we advance the field of medicine. And so by enrolling in a clinical trial, not only is the patient potentially benefiting themselves, but they are certainly benefiting patients who are going to be in their situation years down the road.
Yeah. And so you did mention the phase three. So phase three essentially means that this is a treatment or a drug that's been already studied before on a number
right.
of people. There's reason to believe that it is beneficial, and then its safety has kind of already been
safe. That's right. So
it's already been determined.
Right. So the safety has been determined by phase one trials, which we have not participated in yet, but we certainly could. But that's a different scenario altogether. And in fact, you know, those patients have to be willing to be, quote, experimented on, end quote. So, but trials in this situation that we're talking about, these are, you know, patients that have a potentially curable illness, and so we are not experimenting on them. They are receiving, at a minimum, they're receiving the standard of care treatment that they would get no matter where they, you know, went anywhere in the country, again, with the addition of of another treatment that may improve their outcome.
So they're being... the people who get the experimental treatment are being, their results are being compared to the people who get the standard treatment.
Right.
And then there's a lot of math and statistics that are done to determine which one is better.
These trials are heavily regulated by the FDA, and there is a lot of science. There's a lot of data collection that goes into it. That's actually another benefit for patients on clinical trials, because when we treat patients on clinical trials, everything has to be done very much by the book. Every, you know, I has to be dotted and T has to be crossed, and so patients can, you know, are essentially guaranteed they're receiving very precise care as it was meant to be given. And then, yes, there's a lot of math afterwards, and these patients are followed for several years, measuring outcomes and recurrence rates and survival, and then that's how we determine if the new treatment is better than the previous standard treatment.
Yeah, you mentioned the, you know, dotting the I's, crossing the T's, following very closely for a long time, making sure everything is standardized. And, you know, my understanding is that one of the reasons why the control group or the standard of care group is incorporated is because they find that because these folks treated on the clinical trials are getting such meticulous attention that they tend to do better than the average person anyway. So what, I mean, if you look at it compared to like historical standards, so, you know, I always tell folks who ask me that question, you know, that's one of the reasons people tend to do better statistically, even if they get the standard of care.
So, absolutely.
Yeah.
You're listening to a repeat broadcast of Health Matters. No phone calls will be taken tonight.
So we only have about another 10 minutes left in the show, and we have time for perhaps one more caller. Again, the number is 800-552-8502. I do want to touch on a little bit about ovarian cancer. That's probably the third main cancer that women encounter, and obviously it's a pretty serious one. Dr. Black, could you say just a little bit about ovarian cancer in terms of the symptoms and the treatment?
Yeah, so ovarian cancer is really a tough one because we don't have a screening tool for ovarian cancer, and the patients do have symptoms like endometrial cancer. They have symptoms, but the problem is the symptoms are very vague. The most common symptoms are abdominal pain, bloating, difficulty with urination, feeling full quickly. Abdominal distension patients will sometimes experience. But these symptoms are sometimes mistaken for other issues like gastrointestinal issues. And unfortunately, most women aren't diagnosed until an advanced stage, usually stage 3, which means the cancer has already spread past the ovary into the abdominal cavity. And so to treat ovarian cancer, there's two parts to it. One of them is surgery and one of them is chemotherapy, and you really have to have both of them. And, you know, the way we do it, the order of it, sometimes we start with chemotherapy first, sometimes we start with surgery. That decision is very much individualized based on examination findings and also on imaging. But another important thing about ovarian cancer is we nowadays perform genetic testing on everybody who's diagnosed with ovarian cancer. And that's very important, not just for them personally for their treatment, but also for their family members to know if this is something that's running in the family. Even if they have no family history of ovarian cancer, we still do this this genetic testing.
Now, you mentioned Lynch syndrome as a genetic syndrome that puts people at risk for uterine cancer. But now, what about ovarian cancer? Are there specific syndromes that they're looking for?
So actually, Lynch syndrome does have a higher risk for ovarian cancer than in the general population. In the general population, your lifetime risk is like 1 in 70. And with Lynch syndrome, you do have a little bit higher risk of having ovarian cancer. But the ones that we see more commonly when we do the genetic testing, if it does show a genetic predisposition, is what we call BRCA mutation. BRCA1 and BRCA2 is how sometimes you'll hear your doctor call it. And this is something that's autosomal dominant, and you know, so each child has a 50% chance of actually getting the genetic predisposition, getting that mutation. And if the individual does have it, the chances of getting cancer of the ovary or breast are greatly increased.
So I guess we actually had a caller. They texted in, actually. And their question was, do any of the doctors on the panel think it's sometimes good to have a preventative hysterectomy if you have a family history of any of these cancers, ovarian cancer, uterine cancer, cervical cancer, or perhaps a known genetic predisposition?
Well, actually, I would say that depends. It depends on the family history. It depends on the individual, the patient's age, their desires for fertility. I mean, nowadays we're learning more about ovarian cancer. It's actually thought the most common, most deadly type of ovarian cancer, which is an epithelial type, is actually thought to not start on the ovary, but actually start on the fallopian tube. So that's kind of out there, and that's kind of a big deal because there's a lot of women that have what we call a tubal ligation, or they have their tubes tied, and they wouldn't mind just having a salpingectomy, a removal of their tubes after they've finished, childbearing, maybe at the time of their last cesarean section. Go ahead and have those tubes, the entire tube, including the fimbria, removed. So we're learning a lot about ovarian cancer right now, a lot more about it. But one of the newest things is that we think it most likely starts in the fallopian tube. So in terms of to remove everything or just have everything taken out, that's really an individualized decision. And that would be one that depends on many, many different factors. Because surgery is, although it's very safe, it's still not without risk.
Yeah. Now, Dr. McDonald, I imagine you see a fair number of women and you check with breast cancer and where the BRCA1 and 2 genes are important. What kind of conversations do you have with women who end up testing positive for this in terms of preventative therapy or maybe how they get their disease treated?
So if they get diagnosed with a BRCA mutation after being diagnosed with breast cancer?
Correct.
Yeah, so, yes, we talk about that a lot. And like Dr. Black was saying, it has to do with age and childbearing potential and that sort of thing. Most of the time, if we can, to generalize a little bit, most of the time if we have a woman who's through having children, and has a known BRCA mutation, we would generally recommend a prophylactic hysterectomy with removal of the ovaries as well and the fallopian tubes. And the reverse could be true too, because we can sometimes diagnose these genetic mutations after a diagnosis of ovarian cancer, and then we talk about prophylactic surgery to prevent breast cancer as well. So it sort of works both ways there.
Yeah. Prophylactic meaning to preventative.
Right.
Without there actually being cancer.
Before a cancer develops, yeah. That's right.
And so Angelina Jolie, I guess, is the most famous person who had this done. And interestingly, people think that she had breast cancer and so had both of her breasts removed, but that's not actually the case. Is it, Dr. Rosen?
I don't think so. I'm familiar with it. And she had a large impact on a number of women. Obviously it's important that the caller understands you're referring to a specific genetic abnormality that put her at very high risk of getting cancer. For the vast majority of women, which is off of our topic today, keeping the breast is advantageous.
Yeah. So I guess the take-home message for the evening keep the phone number of your gynecologist handy, go for your annual visits, and if there's something abnormal, don't necessarily ignore it. With the ovarian cancer, is there any, or for that matter, for any of these cancers, is there anything preventative that women could do for ovarian cancer, uterine cancer, or cervical cancer?
Well, it depends on the cancer, but specifically to ovarian cancer, actually, birth control pills have been shown to decrease your risk by 50%. So we definitely talk to patients about that are at higher risk. We like for them to take them for at least 5 years to decrease their risk of ovarian cancer. There are surgical options to help prevent, and that's a conversation that we definitely have with patients that have a genetic predisposition.
What about smoking?
Smoking is bad.
Okay.
Yeah,
so that's the period. End of discussion.
Okay.
Smoking is, of the cancers we discussed today, I think the one associated with it is cervical cancer, most closely associated. It's not really a risk factor for endometrial or ovarian cancer, but for cervical cancer, it's definitely a modifiable risk factor.
Okay. And last question. For women who've taken fertility drugs, are they at are they at higher risk for developing ovarian cancer, or is there any special screening like ultrasounds that should be done in that population?
And so that the data on that is very controversial. There have been some studies that show they may have a slightly higher risk if they've taken some fertility drugs, but it's not accepted as being, you know, set in stone that they do have a higher risk. And there is not a special screening that we do for, like, say, ultrasound or CA125, so that's not been shown to improve overall survival.
Okay, well, this has been a very informative discussion this evening, and I want to thank my guests for joining us this evening. And again, that's Dr. Black, Dr. McDonald, and Dr. Rosen, all at the Willis Knighton Cancer Center. Health Matters is a program for informational purposes only. For all health questions, you should consult a physician or health professional. This show is available for download from redriverradio.org. Views expressed on Health Matters may not necessarily express those of Red River Radio, LSUS, or its staff. Health Matters is a production of Red River Radio. The producer is Renee Moran. Phone assistance has been provided this evening by Wally Derleth. Production of Health Matters is made possible in part by the Knowles Foundation and the Community Foundation of North Louisiana. Please join us next Thursday for Health Matters. I'm Dr. Sanford Katz. Thank you for joining us this evening.